From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new look at taxes and trade, what a Donald Trump administration could mean for the auto industry and its workers.
The United Auto Workers, I think, are ironically finding a potential ally in a Republican administration in Donald Trump.
Group businesses together and then build a brand. It worked for Little Italy, for Chinatown. How about black-owned businesses in Grand Rapids?
It's more of a cultural experience, and so it's not exclusionary. It's one of the ways in which we can present our culture to the broader community.
A children's book tells the story of Native Americans walking around the Great Lakes to save them.
As people see them walking and as people hear their message, they will then pay attention to the water and what's going on.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Daniel, all through the campaign, Mr. Trump railed about Ford and its plans to send a small car production to Mexico. And at the same time, he never acknowledged that Executive Chairman Bill Ford has said no American jobs will be lost. And Ford called Trump's criticism infuriating and frustrating. So there is a strained history, no?
There is, but the other part, side of the coin is that the two men did meet in New York, my understanding is, and they did have a conversation about this. And Trump has since been public and effusive in his praise of Bill Ford, has acknowledged some of the complaints that Ford Motor Company has about high corporate taxes and the cost of health care and regulations that they have to contend with, and I think has been sympathetic. You know, I think Donald Trump understands what the auto industry is dealing with. And I think, frankly, he probably does understand that, in fact, that the removal of small car production in Wayne, Michigan was going to be replaced by what are, we understand, and we broke this story more than a year ago, a new Ranger pickup, which is being built in other parts of the world, and probably the revival of the Bronco SUV. I think he understands this. My understanding, too, is, and I just recently wrote about this, is that Ford is very much in contact with the Trump transition and the Trump campaign. CEO Mark Fields said as much this week out of the Los Angeles Auto Show, but I did a little more reporting, and they're very close, in very close contact with them. And that should really not come as a surprise. I think as a general proposition, an automaker is going to be doing that. My understanding is this is the 20th president that the Ford Motor Company in its history has had to deal with. And were it in a Democrat who was elected, who was Hillary Clinton, they'd be doing the exact same thing, bringing their issues to the fore, talking to the transition, advising them potentially on people that they might want to look at or just making suggestions. That's why these car companies have big Washington shops with people who are very well connected in the political world.
When we think about some history, congressional Republicans strongly opposed that 2009 federal bailout that basically rescued the domestic auto industry, although we should note that process was begun by George W. Bush and then taken to completion by President Obama. Why would automakers feel at all encouraged or feel that things could be stronger for them under a Trump presidency?
Well, I think it has more to do with the macroeconomic situation, corporate taxes being a very good example. You know, Donald Trump has voiced a lot of concern for what he calls the forgotten man and the forgotten woman. And I think that translates in our world here as the lunch bucket crowd, the union folks who work in plants, who go to work, play by the rules. And that is actually an asset, I think, potentially to the automakers on the management side and also on the union side. The United Auto Workers, I think, are ironically finding a potential ally in a Republican administration in Donald Trump. If, in fact, he does begin some negotiations with Justin Trudeau in Canada and with their counterpart in Mexico and starts to, you know, reopen NAFTA, look at some things, tighten some things up, that very much is in the wheelhouse of the UAW. And President Dennis Williams is already on record saying, you know, he'd be willing to work with President Trump on that. But I think the longer-term goal for the Democrats out there listening to this is, this has potential resonance across the industrial Midwest, which really delivered the White House to Donald Trump. And if he is successful in doing that, and if he is credited with making a change and rolling back or redoing the NAFTA world that this industry and we in Michigan and Ohio have known for more than 20 years, that could have profound political implications 4 years from now.
And would you try to parse Trump's statements that we've heard about currency manipulation or health care and trade? What are you hearing from auto executives? What do they think it means for auto companies?
Well, currency manipulation is a real big issue and has been for many, many years. Now, there are people on the other side of the argument who say that the Japanese and the Chinese are not manipulating their currency, and that's just an excuse. I think the car companies would come back to you and say, no, it's not an excuse, and we understand this a lot better than you do. You know, we live in a global economy, despite what some of the things Trump said on the campaign trail, and we will continue to live in a global economy. That said, there are national economic stresses that I think are coming to the fore. You're seeing it in the United States. You're seeing it in parts of Western Europe. You're going to continue to see that. And so what I think politicians are going to have to be reckoning is this tension between the global companies that are headquartered in their countries and the needs that they have, and they are employers in their countries, and the political atmosphere that they're operating in. Where that ultimately goes, I don't know. But, I mean, clearly we've seen with the Brexit vote in the UK, we've seen Marine Le Pen in France, who is an ultra-right politician from the National Front, who I think a lot of people think could be successful in the next polling in France, which would be kind of the Donald Trump of France. And Germany seems to be somewhat quiescent, but they're dealing with their own issues. But clearly, these kinds of issues that we're talking about are very important in a country like Germany. And that doesn't even get into places like China and others. So, you know, there's going to be this tension as we go forward. And I think what the companies are looking at is if we can get some improvement on the macroeconomic environment that we and our people are operating in, that's a net plus for us. Because despite the fact that President Obama clearly did, as you said at the top, execute the rescue of the auto companies, particularly GM and Chrysler, in 2009. His administration also spent 8 years layering more and more and more regulations and tougher fuel economy regulations that really outstripped the ability of the companies to keep up. So we're now at a point where they've improved fuel efficiency, but the curve going forward to 2025 is getting steeper and steeper and steeper. And I think one of the things they hope is that under a Trump administration by 2018, they're going to start to relook at those rules. And as one executive said to me, they're going to let data drive the rulemaking process, not politics. And I think what they see is that in a lot of cases in the Obama years, politics and environmental politics specifically has been driving a lot of environmental policymaking.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Bob Seger's House and Other Stories is the title of a masterful anthology of short fiction done by some of Michigan's best living writers. The settings in these stories include the frozen landscape of the Upper Peninsula, a drug house in Detroit, a suburban office cubicle, and the top of a Ferris wheel at a rural county fair. The characters range in age from an unborn child to a 90-year-old war veteran to a ghost who's well over a century old. Author Lisa Lenzo has this Michigan bookmark.
The stories in this diverse anthology, edited by Michael Delp and M.L. Liebler, are presented in many forms. There is an allegory, a fable, historical fiction, and even a Western-style tall tale. Magical realism transports us to the heavens, and plain old-fashioned realism grounds us to the earth. One hilarious story includes lines of script-like dialogue that the main character, a frustrated playwright, creates only in her head. A short, short story, less than a page long, packs more punch, word for word, than any story I've ever read. All of the main characters in this anthology are arresting. An old man's mostly good life is overshadowed by an atrocity he witnessed as a young soldier. An unborn child has only the tiniest of chances that she will escape a multitude of birth defects. A young woman battles a frightening bout of mental illness without any real help. Some of these stories nudge us toward gentle realizations. A college student is reminded that we are often walk-ons rather than the main actors on life's stage. A middle-aged woman travels to Tokyo expecting to discover something significant, but is pleased when she simply shares a moment of camaraderie and learns the Japanese words for drizzle and rain. A few stories in this anthology are downright harrowing. A girl is far more responsible than it seems at first for the death of her childhood friend. An innocent-seeming neighbor turns out to be a twisted murderer. But humor appears in this collection, too. One story opens with a bride in a church toilet stall trying to insert a tampon with her mother and her maid of honor standing on seats in adjoining stalls and holding up the bride's dress. In a medicinal mushroom-inspired epic, a Native American elder leads a sweat lodge for suburban white people, attempting to channel the spirits of their departed pets, including a hamster, a turtle, and a parakeet. This collection could have been aptly titled something grand and all-encompassing, such as Matters of Life and Death. Instead, it's called Bob Seger's House and Other Stories, after the mythical house of the Michigan rock star. Bob Seger's house is that palatial house found in every city and town that catches our attention, the kind we infuse with our dreams. But what stands out in these stories is not the mansion with the fancy gate and pillars and the famous person mistakenly thought to live inside it, but the smaller and simpler things. A young girl's diary, an indie rock band, a HUD house with cracks and leaks. And what matters most in these pages is not an absent rock star, but the characters we actually meet. They suffer and sometimes die, and they also live and dream. It's through them that we more clearly see and appreciate our communities and the rest of the world, in all their horror and sorrow, their mystery and beauty.
Lisa Lenzo is the author of two award-winning collections of short fiction. Her latest book, Strange Love, was the recipient of a Michigan Notable Book Award for 2015. Her review of Bob Seger's House and Other Stories is part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find her review at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They're known as the Mother Earth Water Walkers. Two Anishinaabe grandmothers, joined by Anishinaabe women and men, walking the perimeter of the Great Lakes. They're hoping to raise awareness of the environmental and man-made threats against these lakes. They began walking in 2003. Since then, the Water Walkers have covered all of the 11,525-mile perimeter around the Great Lakes. And that's not all. They've walked along other waterways around the country, and they're continuing to plan more walks. Their story is now told in a beautiful children's book called Water Walkers by Brighton author Carol Trembath, with illustrations by David W. Craig. It tells the story of a little Ojibwe girl named Mai. Take a listen.
As I walked, I remembered my grandmother's words to her Ojibwe people. Our sacred water is in trouble. We will walk long distances with water in our copper pail and pray for the water with each step. We will circle the lakes to protect them for our children and our grandchildren. Grandmother planned to walk around each of the Great Lakes one by one. She taught me that it is our Ojibwe people's custom to watch over and protect the water. I thought about grandmother's words. I wondered how I could help. Grandmother told us we would start the first water walk around the big lake, Gichigami, Lake Superior. I wanted to go too, but my big sister Winona and Uncle Joe said, "Mai, you are too little to go." My grandmother said, "Even our little ones can make ripples and waves. Mai will tell me what she sees, because she sees like the clever coyote." From then on, I became a water walker for Mother Earth.
That was Carol Trembath reading an excerpt of her children's book, Water Walkers, and she joins us now. So this story was inspired by Josephine Mandeman and the other real-life water walkers, and their mission was to walk around all of the Great Lakes to do exactly what?
Well, Josephine Mandeman is Ojibwe, and the chief of the Three Fires is Eddie Benton Bonnet. Eddie Benton Bonnet had a vision in 2003, and the vision was this: that in 30 years, if we do not take care of the water, an ounce of water will be the price of an ounce of gold. Josephine took up the challenge, and she decided to begin walking around the Great Lakes and down rivers and waterways to bring attention to the water. It's called collective consciousness. As people see them walking and as people hear their message, they will then pay attention to the water and what's going on.
And in your story, Little Mai is a great device because it helps you tell the story of what the water walkers did and why, and we learn about it through her eyes. What were the walks like?
Well, the real walks, the Native people get up every morning at 5:30, and they go to the water, they bless the water, they sing to the water, and they leave their gift of tobacco. It is symbolic. But these are sacred words, and I went on the Ohio River Walk, and I saw on a rainy, gray day exactly what happened. These songs are sacred, and so they asked the TV cameras to be turned off. And again, they do believe that water is life-giving force, and just like we would pray to have someone who is sick be great in health again, they do the same, and they do this every day. And then they walk 40 to 50 miles a day. When they went around Lake Superior, it took them 36 days of walking. They are joined by other people when they go around cities, but yes, they have walked a tremendous amount of time.
And as we learned from reading your book, Water Walkers, they carry a copper pail. Why is that?
Copper is sacred to the Native American people. The reason is 5,000 years ago in the Midwest, they found copper in the UP. And ever since then, it has been one of their sacred elements. Whenever there is a situation in the Native reservations that someone is abused or in pain, they do take the copper pail around, walk around the reservation, and ask for donations with the copper pail.
So therefore, that copper pail is really for the Great Lakes.
Yes, it is.
Now, you've dedicated your book to this grandmother, Josephine, who came up with the idea. Tell us more about Josephine.
Josephine is an Ojibwe grandmother. She is not an elder. She has a great deal of strength and is an active, real-life Native American hero working every day to help the water.
Now, you are not Native American, are you?
No, I am not.
And how were you received when you started saying, I want to write this book? Was there any sense of, well, we'd rather have somebody from our side write it, or did they welcome you?
Well, there are two things going on here. The first is David W. Craig. He is the illustrator.
And David is Native American.
David is Native American, too. He was the only one that I sent the story to. And his agent called me back and said, David has been asked many times to do stories. This is the first one he's agreed to do. Now, how it's been received, I saw Josephine in Thanksgiving time 3 years ago. And I gave her a preliminary copy of the book. And she said, well, it's not accurate. I said, well, it's fiction. But she also emailed me in January. And she said, I had misgivings about what you are doing. She said, it is our tradition to speak orally or draw. That is not your tradition. I respect that. But we asked in ceremony, what is it that she wants, meaning me? Is it for ego, fame, or money? And the answer came back, it is for the water, simply for the water. And so I give you my blessing and can rest easy. I have dedicated the book to her. She has allowed me to put her picture into the book and put in that email so Native American people will understand that I'm not in it for the trophy. I'm in it to help. I'm on a mission to help.
And I know you're going into schools and presenting a learning program tied around that, harkening back to your years as a teacher and librarian. What's in the program?
The purpose of this is to bring an awareness to children and understand their stewardship that they need to protect and take care of the water. It has been said over and over that our next crisis will not be oil. Our next crisis is going to be water.
And are you planning more stories about Mai? She's an adorable little girl.
Yes, of course I am. The next story will be called Stepping Stones, and it's about her journey around Lake Michigan.
We start with Superior and moving on to Michigan, so there are certainly more stories. Well, it is absolutely a beautiful story, and I know you're hoping that the children who read this become more aware than ever about preserving the Great Lakes.
Absolutely.
Carol Trembeth of Brighton, her children's book is Water Walkers, and again, beautifully illustrated by David W. Craig. You can check out her website, caroltrembeth.com, if you want to find out more about having that learning program brought to your school. Thank you so much for being with us.
I need to say, in Ojibwe, chi migwich, which means in Ojibwe, thank you very much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
One proven way to give local business a boost is by grouping them together, building a brand. Detroit's Greek Town and Mexican Town come to mind, or Little Italy or Chinatown in other cities. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is working to make that happen for Black-owned businesses in Grand Rapids. Jamil Robinson is the founder and curator of the group Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses, or GRAB. Jamil, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to found this group? I guess what problem are you trying to solve or opportunity you're trying to create?
What led me to start this was just giving, growing up here in Grand Rapids during the height of the 80s and the 90s and seeing not a lot taking place, and then we fast-forwarded to the early 2000s, 2005, Wealthy Street, which was once predominantly an African-American business district, seemed like overnight had become a gentrified district, meaning that a lot of businesses that were once African-American were no longer in existence, and new businesses from those who didn't necessarily grow up in the area was in the area and seeing how it wasn't necessarily social services that led to a change in the community, but it was rather economic development in the form of public and private investments in the area.
So they come in and kind of push out some longstanding businesses.
Yes. So So some longstanding businesses that's been in the area, a lot of consorted effort around organizing. And so that's when you saw the historic preservation. So Wealthy Street was certified as a historic preservation district around that same time, which, you know, led to higher costs. So if you want to reinvest in your facade of your business because of the cost of original material, it typically wasn't an affordable option. And so businesses that were once African American, you know, weren't after a while. And now on the whole stretch of Wealthy Street or the district, there's only two African American owned businesses in that whole stretch.
How can the Grand Rapids area black businesses that you founded pump that life back into black businesses?
Some of the ways that we're doing is just overall awareness creation, but also leveraging the existing resources, but then also seeing how those existing resources haven't traditionally worked for minority businesses, especially African-American-owned businesses. So it's getting with those policymakers or those who have created resources or structured the way these resources work to get with them and see if we can retrofit that program to where it can better serve those looking to access those resources that have traditionally not been able to access those resources.
And what kind of businesses would you be looking at pulling into this umbrella of the Grand Rapids area black businesses?
Oh, we're looking at any and all businesses that are seeking to belong. And I know that sounds extremely broad and kind of grandiose, but it takes a lot of different businesses. So just like the Right Place here in West Michigan seeks to attract these bigger employers that can employ hundreds of people at a time, well, those hundreds of people eventually have to live in a neighborhood. And so those people who are potentially earning high salaries, once they are in a neighborhood, they're looking to support their businesses. And so you have to have a mixed income area. And so having the businesses of all scale, those who can be mass employers, but those down to your what was traditionally called mom and pops, now called lifestyle businesses, having those and everyone kind of benefiting from the overall economic development that's taking place in our community. And so we're looking for lifestyle businesses, we're looking for tech companies, manufacturers, and all the different type of businesses to be a part of GRAP, because it will take a collective of all the businesses coming together to be able to bring about sustainable change when it comes to the quality of life for African Americans here in Grand Rapids, which isn't all that well, given the fact that Grand Rapids last year was ranked 51 out of 52 as worst places for African Americans economically.
And when you think of the benefits of having a black business district, Jamil, what are they for the businesses as well as for consumers?
Oh, the advantages of having a black-owned business district is similar to, as you kind of stated with your open of, when you think of Greektown, when you think of Chinatown, it's a cultural experience. But currently, because there isn't a defined district, or there isn't a district that a lot of African-American businesses have come together to kind of occupy, they're kind of scattered and spread out. So if you're looking to support multiple businesses, it'll take you at least a half a day to just be able to make it to those businesses that are brick and mortar. So you may have to drive from Grand Rapids to like three or four of the surrounding suburbs in order to support just five businesses. But if they were located geographically within an area, it makes it extremely relevant. But then it's also a cultural experience for those who are seeking to support businesses that are owned by African Americans.
And for folks who aren't real familiar with Grand Rapids layout, where would you like to see this business district located?
In what is known as Southtown area by some, but the streets that I like to see this district on will either be between Eastern and Franklin, with Wealthy Street being on the north side and Franklin Street being on the southern border, or even in the Madison area, or even the Boston Square area. So those are three corridors where it's predominantly African-American residents live. And so since we already have a high population of African-Americans within that area, and we do have some African-American businesses located within there, that's the lowest hanging fruit.
Jamil, what do you say to people who say that having an African-American business district who say, well, isn't that exclusionary? What do you say to that?
What I typically say is, if you just think about it in the way of we just mentioned earlier, not to keep, you know, beating the same horse, but no one says that about Little China, or no one says that about Little Havana and all these other places, because it's more of a cultural experience. And so it's not exclusionary. It's one of the ways in which we can present our culture to the broader community in a greater context. But then also, given the fact that, you know, the African-American businesses tend to have common issues, them being closer to one another will help when it comes to overall support. So like accessing capital is a barrier, and then also policies that support the growth of small businesses are barriers, just because we don't tend to see a lot of policy or a concerted effort for a sustainable amount of time as far as being developed or being invested in African-American businesses. So African-American businesses as a whole and African-Americans as a whole have been pretty much locked out of the majority of economic opportunity through exclusionary policies that pretty much goes to the founding of America. And so one of the ways in which we're looking to help alleviate some of those systematic and institutional barriers is by proximity. Because if you are African-American business, so you think of it kind of as a support group where you may have someone who has found a way around a certain issue or a certain barrier, closeness and proximity to one another sort of helps with the longevity of these businesses. And so it's not necessarily an exclusionary thing. It's, you know, these are businesses that for the longest haven't had an opportunity when it comes to accessing equal opportunity.
Now, you've got a busy week with a pair of events Friday, the Grab Black Market and Awards, and the Shift Summit that's going to be at Grand Valley State University. What are these events? Who are they aimed at?
Yeah, the Shift Summit is taking place in the mid-morning, so that noon to approximately 4 p.m. And the summit is geared towards any and everyone, so those who are African-American business owners, entrepreneurs, anyone who's looking to be an entrepreneur, anyone who's working to empower neighborhoods, are definitely welcome. But then anyone who is looking to support or be an ally to the work in which we're looking to do when it comes to bringing down some of those statistical numbers when it comes to unemployment, poverty rate, and then also overall quality of life. And so that's the Shift Summit. And so we have Dr. Jessica Gordon-Newhart, who's a professor of community justice and social economic development from John Jay College out of New York. She's going to be our keynote presenter. She's also the author of a book where it talks about alternative economic development models, particularly co-ops and the history of co-ops within the Black community.
And then the Grab Black Market and Awards?
Yes, the Black Market and Awards. The Black Market is kind of a play on words. The Black Market always takes place the Friday before Black Friday. And so it's kind of a way for us to be extremely intentional with our dollars and supporting African-American businesses before the quote-unquote kickoff of the holiday season, which is typically Black Friday. And so this is a way for us to be able to support those businesses. But then also, we added on an awards component for the last 3 years, where it's just us looking to affirm and celebrate those within African-American community that have been making a real impact in fighting to make Grand Rapids an equitable place and a world-class city for all residents, and not just those who have historically benefited from everything Grand Rapids has to offer.
Well, good luck with all the events this week and as you continue along with your work with the Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses and trying to build this Black Central Business District in Grand Rapids. Jamil Robinson, who's the founder of Grab. Thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea, Jamil.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The FBI is digging more deeply into Detroit's demolition program, one of Mayor Mike Duggan's centerpiece programs. On Wednesday, agents took computers and documents from the offices of the Detroit Land Bank Authority. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is with us now. Sarah, remind everyone just what the land bank does.
So the land bank is actually not technically part of the city government. It's a public authority, but it does have very close ties to the city government, obviously, and particularly to Mayor Mike Duggan. What the land bank does, and it's been around for a while, but Duggan has made it much more prominent under his administration, is it sort of serves as a central clearinghouse for all of the or it's supposed to serve as a central clearinghouse for all the vacant properties and issues that Detroit has had with blight. It's supposed to be like, hey, the land bank will sort of take these properties, you know, under its own umbrella and figure out what to do with them. And that'll be a much quicker and more efficient way of tackling the longstanding issues Detroit has had with blight.
And there's a lot of federal money used in all of this.
Yes. Well, in terms of these demolitions, the land bank has done the majority, I think about 80% of the more than 10,000 that Duggan has done in the past not quite 3 years under his administration. But the land bank has received about, or Detroit has received, and other cities throughout Michigan have gotten a lot of federal money from what's called the Hardest Hit Fund, which is a U.S. Treasury federal program. And that was initially meant to help people who were facing foreclosure to stay out of foreclosure. But the feds actually said, allowed them to reprogram this money and say this can be used for blight demolition. So in Detroit's case, so far they've used almost $130 million on demolitions from Hardest Hit, and they've been appropriated about twice that going forward.
So what do we think of? What are these investigations about? How much do we know?
Well, we certainly don't know everything, but it's been widely reported and it's widely understood that they're looking into allegations of potential bid rigging, especially at the very beginning when the demolitions first started to heat up, that certain contractors were favored over others, even brought into conversations very early, and that whole bid process was really not appropriate. We also know the land bank admitted last month that, in fact, you know, as a result of its own internal investigation, that it misused some federal funds and that someone somewhere, you know, was dealt with appropriately for doing that, misused them by using federal funds for expenses that federal funds should not have been used for. So it seems like there's a whole bunch of things going on here. We're not quite sure of the whole scope.
And we know the U.S. Treasury Department, it was kind of had the land bank in its doghouse, right? It suspended the city's demolition program from August to October.
Yeah, they did. And that came as kind of a big surprise to everyone. I think when Mayor Duggan announced last month that that had happened, he announced it not when the program was suspended, but when, in fact, the money, the federal money, was restored. But it had was revealed that it had been suspended because both the Michigan State Housing Development Authority and the Treasury had looked into how the land bank did business, and they found a whole number of problems with it. And they didn't restore that funding until they had put some new watchdogs and controls in place.
So kind of here we are, the spotlight back on the land bank. What happened on Wednesday?
So we were finally, after sort of long day of trying to get straight what had happened, it turned out apparently that what had happened is that the FBI basically went to the land bank, and some people from the land bank were there and handed them a whole bunch of information, reportedly, you know, everything from documents to computer hard drives to whatever other information they were looking for. We don't exactly know the scope of that. It's not clear yet if a search warrant was in fact executed or how this was all arranged. But what it appears to be is that this ongoing probe into the land bank, which we knew that the FBI had started earlier this year, really seems to be picking up speed at this point.
And what are we hearing from the U.S. Attorney's Office?
They're being quite tight-lipped about all this. All they will say is that the land bank and the city has been cooperating with this investigation and that it is an ongoing investigation. But we should probably know more next month when there's a circuit court hearing. A division of the Treasury has issued subpoenas, but so far they've been kept under wraps. But those may be revealed, and it's expected at that point that we'll probably get some more insight into sort of the status and nature of the whole federal investigation, at least.
And has there been any comment from anyone from the land bank?
There has been, but it's been pretty boilerplate comment, just to say that we can't really comment on an ongoing investigation, and we've been fully cooperating with those investigations.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick bringing us up to date as the Detroit Land Bank turns over computers and documents to federal investigators as this probe widens. Thank you so much for being with us, Sarah.
Thank you.
Tomorrow night, a football state championship is on the line as Deckerville High School and Powers North Central High square off. They'll play in Greenville, just northeast of Grand Rapids. It might look like your average high school football game, but there's a difference. Instead of 11 players a side, there will be only 8. That's because Michigan has seen the second biggest drop in high school football participation in the nation, and that's forcing schools, especially smaller schools, to play eight-man football. What's behind the drop, and should we worry at all about the future of the sport in Michigan? We turn now to John Johnson, the communications director with the Michigan High School Athletic Association. What's behind the drop in the number of kids choosing to play high school football?
Well, you have to slice this up, Cynthia. First of all, if you're looking at the drop as a whole, it's a drop of 11 man is what's happening with the schools now, numbering over 60 that have made the move to eight-man football because of the numbers game of their enrollments going down. And so when you talk about, well, Michigan is losing kids playing football, it's a variety of things that contribute to it, and the biggest one of them is the population drop. We've had over a 12% population drop over about the last decade or so in 14 to 17-year-old girls and boys, and while overall participation in high school sports has remained relatively stable during that time, football has seen a drop that's a little bit faster than what the population drop would be. And so, you know, there's a variety of reasons for it. You know, one, just don't have the numbers anymore. The other things are, you know, some people do have the bejeebers scared out of them because of health issues. And talking to some coaches, they say kids just don't want to put that kind of effort forth anymore. And so a variety of things, but it's our smallest schools that have left the 11-man game, gone to the 8-man game, and that certainly has had an effect on 11-man participation statewide because we've got like about 60, 70 fewer schools that are playing football now at the 11-man level than there were a decade ago.
Well, let's talk about some of these things coaches are hearing from parents. And certainly the concussion issue is completely, on the front burner when we talk about football in America. And the number of concussions reported are actually on the rise in recent years. Is this because we're more aware of concussions and they're being reported more?
It's absolutely because we are so much more aware than we've ever been about what to look for and in the mindset, in some regards, of our football players. You know, you think of that old gutted out mentality that's existed in sports in general, but football in particular, you know, for a long, long time. People are beginning to see they got to make the healthy choice. It's not about getting your bell rung anymore. If you think you got your bell rung, you probably got a concussion. But the studies that we did over the course of the last year in all sports, we had every school in the state report all of their head injuries to us. And we found an average of 1.6 concussions, I believe it was, per 1,000 last year across the state of Michigan. But the interesting thing that we found was that there were more concussions by girls than boys. Proportionately, girls than boys. Sharply in the same sport, soccer, basketball, that sort of thing. But we think some of the reason we didn't have as many concussions reported by boys last year was because they didn't want to do the right thing and say, hey, I think I got hurt. Girls are more willing to do so. So there's a lot of different things when you look at concussions as a whole. How do we coach boys and girls differently in sports to minimize injury risk? But what do we do to get 14 to 17-year-olds to say, hey, I got hurt?
Yeah, I don't want to look bad in coaches' eyes, even though, you know, we expect coaches are looking for this and want to intervene if somebody gets their bell rung.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's maybe not their coaches, but their peers. You know, Johnny doesn't want to be seen as a wuss, you know, by the kids that he sits in the classroom with every day because he came out of the game. But again, you know, we think the numbers, when we get everything compiled from the fall, are going to be up compared to last year, and we're going to say, good, we're getting better reporting than ever before. People should not be scared of the fact that those numbers are going up because it means we're getting a handle on all of this.
John, I know the NFL has been pushing this youth program called Heads Up Football to teach kids a safer method of tackling, hoping to minimize injuries and concussions. A couple high schools in Michigan have even implemented no-contact practices, hoping to minimize injuries. Is the sport any safer with efforts like these, or is it even possible to make a game like football safe? And I'll use air quotes with that word, safe.
Well, you make a game as safe as you can. You make an automobile as safe as you can. Just because, you know, people have died in automobile accidents doesn't mean that we've pulled people out of automobiles. football, if you look over time, has a track record at the high school level in particular of getting safer all the time. If you look at the catastrophic injuries that are compiled by the University of North Carolina every year, catastrophic injuries, I'm talking about life-ending injuries, debilitating injuries, all of those are down compared to the 70s and the 80s. Improvements have been made to equipment, to rules, to teaching techniques, all kinds of things. The fact that our kids are bigger, faster, stronger than ever before in some ways helps minimize injury as well. The high school game is right now is as safe as it can possibly be. You can't go out there and tell people your kid's not going to get hurt playing any sport. You know, I had a kid who had bad feet from cross country and track. The sport carries with it an inherent risk. Everybody's got to go into that with their eyes wide open.
I want to jump back to something you had mentioned. You're hearing from some of the reasons why you see some kids choosing to not play. You use the phrase, don't want to put forth the effort. What do you think is happening here?
Well, I think, society has changed in so many different ways. There are so many more things than ever before that call for our attention, in particular for kids. Some kids now have to work to help support a family. You've got kids who get burned out on sports before they even get to high school. 80% of youth sports participants quit sports by the time they turn 13. That's a national statistic. And so, you know, so the pool itself is, you know, is smaller of athletes. And, some people just, take a look and says, I don't want to do all that work. I'd rather go play my video game.
John Johnson, Communications Director with the Michigan High School Athletic Association. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, Cynthia, appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
And we turn to Kevin Belfi. He's head coach of the Powers North Central football team in Spalding in the western part of the UP, currently traveling downstate with his team for Friday's 8-man state championship game. So you moved from 11-man to 8-man football 2 years ago. Why was that?
We had struggles with numbers. Our community and our parents wanted us to provide a JV and a varsity football program. And we were only getting about three JV games per year. And then, you know, being a small school, we had low turnout because we didn't have enough kids. We had one class where we only had 7 boys in the class and only 2 played football. So that put a real crunch on numbers. You know, we had some success. The last 5 years we played 11-man football. We made playoffs 3 times. We won our first ever playoff game in 11-man football in our school's history and then lost the following week in the district final. And then the next year we knew we were going to have troubles with numbers. Again, we had a small class and we played that season with 15 kids, but we probably should have made the switch a year earlier due to numbers. A lot of parents and people in our community were concerned with freshmen and sophomores playing with juniors and seniors, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. Some of the kids just aren't ready to play.
That stands to reason. Your school has, what, about 115 students in total?
Yeah, our high school is 115 kids.
What's the difference between playing 8-man and playing 11-man?
Well, the field's 13 yards more narrow, so it's only 40 yards wide. Obviously, there's 6 less people on it. So the difference is, I think, from what we've seen in the 2 years we've done it, the game plays faster. There's more open spaces, more lanes to get into. Things happen quicker. That's why the scoring's higher. You can play good defense and still rack up a lot of points because if there are good athletes on both sides of the ball, they're going to make plays.
So maybe a little bit faster, but you're not certainly seeing any loss in the quality of the kind of game they're seeing or playing.
It's a different kind of game. You still have to tackle. You still have to block. You still have to catch the ball. You still have to throw the ball. All those things apply. Some of the schools that may have come from 11-man football down to 8-man football may be a little bit ahead of the curve than some schools that are taking up football for the first time and jumping up and just playing 8-player football and not have any experience with it. But, yeah, it's a different kind of football, but you still all the same rules still apply. The kids enjoy it. And with our small numbers, we're able to field a full JV schedule and a full varsity schedule, and our community and our parents really like that.
I understand you're one of the few schools in our state that's gone to no-contact practice. Why was that?
Well, again, you know, with small numbers, they're banged and bruised every week anyway. So, you know, we found other ways to, we hope, and it has this year for sure, and last year, become good tacklers, be able to come into blocking and tackling with minimal contact. I wouldn't say no contact, but as far as tackling goes, we did one live tackling drill this year. That was it. And that was a short form drill, you know, more so it wasn't actually, you know, your big old style Oklahoma drill or anything like that. And the blocking drills, you know, we'll do the shields and we'll try to encourage, you know, foot placement, foot movement, stuff like that. When you have small numbers, you want to kind of try to keep it healthy.
And you're in the state championship game, so it certainly hasn't hurt your on-field play.
You know, I think our kids are good tacklers. Other teams have told us, boy, your kids tackle well. How do you do that? You know, and we show them what we do. And the thing with the donuts, I call them donuts, those big circling round foam padded things. The kids aren't worried about tackling one of their friends or rolling an ankle on one of their friends or putting more bumps and bruises on somebody that's already bumped and bruised. So they really tackle those things correctly, and by the fact of their nature, you can't tackle them high because there's no high part to tackle. It creates good technique. That's helped us a bunch.
Coach, as you're joining the ranks of Michigan schools who are going from 11-man to 8-man football, as you talk to other coaches, do you think that this kind of trend will continue? Do you think we'll see more?
Well, you know, I don't really know a lot about a lot of the schools down in, on the lower side of the peninsula, but in the upper peninsula, over the years, traditionally the schools that we played that were our size, we see them going to just a varsity program and not having a JV program. And then when they go to eight-player football, then their JV program comes back because they don't have to take all the numbers to the varsity. And I think you're going to see more of that, at least in the UP for sure, because as a parent, and, you know, I had a son who's now 30, but when he played, as a parent, I would prefer that a freshman or a sophomore play most of the season with the freshmen and sophomores. At the end of your sophomore season, you may be able to come up and help out the ranks of your varsity team. You're a little bit older, you're a little bit bigger, and experience. I don't really see a correlation between being a big freshman, a great athlete, and then having the experience it takes to be out on the field and not get injured, because some things happen so fast. If you have no experience with it, there's still a better chance that you can become injured.
Coach Kevin Belfi, Powers North Central High School. Good luck Friday night against Deckerville, Coach.
Thank you very much.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.